Welcome to Simple Living Works. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to present part of Tony and Shane Uncut, the complete dialogue in 8 episodes between Tony Campolo and Shane Claiborne on simpler living and global justice, which became the DVD Simply Enough, reissued recently by World Vision Canada as Choose Justice. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, and comprehensive lifestyle. Our mission is to equip people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. To learn more about us, listen to episodes 1 and 2. In this episode, I present one of the 8 parts of Tony and Shane Uncut, a conversation between Tony Campolo and Shane Claiborne. To learn how this powerful dialogue came to be, listen to episode number 3 called The Saga of Simply Enough. The link is in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Our hope is that you will be so motivated by this series that you will want to share the message with others in your congregation or group. Order a copy of the DVD Choose Justice with this extensive discussion guide from the store at thesimpleway.org for only $10. It is also available from World Vision Canada and from Tony Campolo's store. All those addresses are given in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. See pictures of Alternative's crew in Philadelphia producing the original and links to the bonus segments. Links are in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. To get better acquainted with Tony and Shane and their ministries, follow the links in the show notes.
You were mentioning your eating styles at the Simple Way, and on the way up to talking to you today, you mentioned that, you know, it's about that time when you're getting ready to start planting a garden. I mean, you're in the city. Yeah. What in the world are you doing farming in the city?
Oh boy, we're busting every vacant lot up that we can right now. We've reclaimed a lot of abandoned spaces. First of all, as you know, Kensington has over 15,000 abandoned lots, just vacant lots.
They've torn down houses.
700 abandoned factories, 20,000 abandoned houses. Yeah, it's an industrial wasteland, which in itself is very indicative of the economy that we're living in. This is the flip side of the sweatshop. Yeah. This is the wreckage of jobs and, you know, replacement industries of drug addiction and drug trafficking and prostitution. So in the middle of all that, there's a lot of beautiful things in my neighborhood, and there's also a lot of really difficult things. And one of those is that we suffer from, I think one of the things about the culture of poverty is that you go to the corner store and you buy chips for 25 cents. And so there's not a real culture of creating a healthy diet and good food and nutrition and stuff, which my mom's always asking me about, you know. And so we really lived in that for a while. We ate the same stuff we fed people, which was whatever we could round up. You know, a lot of the food from the food bank is not always nutritious. Sometimes it's SpaghettiOs and Twinkies, you know. But we began to go, let's start to rethink how we live together. Let's create a new culture where it's the Catholic workers talk about creating a new society in the shell of the old one. So let's figure out how to grow our own food. So now we have lots that we are gardening on that we've reclaimed. Some of them we own and some we don't. But we call that guerrilla gardening, you know, where we take it over, and we've got roof gardens on top of our house where we try to recycle water, and we try to use the things around us to garden in. So we turn tires, which are everywhere, inside out, and we grow Swiss chard and greens out of them. We have one garden where it's all technology. So we have all the old TVs and computer monitors, and we've hollowed them out. It's kind of like gutting a deer, you know. We make planters with flowers and stuff. So you can see that idea that grass pierces concrete in the middle of it. But we also have a lot of food that we're starting to grow, and particularly in our sister community over in Camden, they have an urban greenhouse that they've made. They have a brick oven where they bake pizzas with the kids in their neighborhood, and the kids can roast marshmallows. And these are urban kids that they haven't necessarily done that. Like, for them, s'mores is, you know, one of the flavors of Pop-Tarts, you know, or something. But, like, to really be able to do that together and to make food together is a beautiful thing. And one of the folks that lived with us...
And it should be noted that, you know, when you go into a poor neighborhood, so many of the people are fat. Mm. And you say, man, these people are eating huge amounts of food. Where's the poverty? These people are all overweight. Upon simple reflection, they're overweight, not because they're eating too much, but because they're eating bad food. Mm-hmm. They're eating potato chips. They're eating fatty foods. They're going to fast food places and buying these, hamburgers and French fries, and they just keep on putting on pounds. Not because they're spending a lot of money on food, but because they're using the wrong food. They're not buying healthy food. And the whole thing you're doing, I think, is important, not just because it's kind of countercultural and all of that, but because I think you're making a statement of the kinds of foods that keep us healthy, the kinds of food that keep us in good health, the kinds of food that keep us from having heart attacks. 4 years ago, I had a stroke. And, when they checked me out, my sugar level was high, cholesterol was high, high blood pressure was high, and they were going to put me on all kinds of medicine. And you know what? I've been able to keep almost all of that under control with very little in the way of medicine, just by simply changing the food that I eat. Mm-hmm. Do you eat healthy? How much bread, white bread, do I eat? There's a good one. How much greasy fats do I eat? How much fish do I eat? One of the things about food that concerns me is the huge amount of beef that we're eating. Mm-hmm. I mean, you talk about a demonic plan. They're destroying the rainforests in Brazil at a rate that staggers the imagination. They tear out an area the size of a football field every minute. Just destroy it. Mm-hmm. In order to make more land available for grazing cattle so that meat can be produced to send to the United States. Now, we're destroying the Amazon at such a rate that we're actually changing weather patterns. And there are people who are saying that the droughts in Africa that are causing incredible death are related to the destruction of the rainforest. Mm-hmm. So people over there are suffering. The indigenous Indians are losing their land and their opportunity to live with the ways that they've always lived. All of this to produce meat to ship to the United States so that we can go to these fast food places and buy hamburgers that give us heart trouble. Yeah. I mean, you know, I believe in the evil one. Mm-hmm. I believe in a satanic plot here that, in fact, is destroying God's creation in the process of destroying people's health. When you take protein in grain, let's say in wheat, and animals eat it, and then we eat the animals, almost 90% of all the protein gets lost on that transition from the protein being produced in the field to it being consumed by the person that's eating the hamburger. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to eliminate world hunger if we continue to get into a lifestyle that demands more and more and more meat. And this is the way we've been tuned. To people in your neighborhood who have had their teeth kicked in day after day after day, the ad comes on and says to these people who have never had a break, you deserve a break today. You know, go and get yourself a hamburger. The seduction of the system.
Yeah, and I mean, right now I read an article that said that America is in the middle of an obesity crisis. It's a national health crisis. That America's folks in the United States are eating themselves to death. Over 300,000 deaths could be prevented if people just didn't overconsume. And at the same time, where we have, you know, one child dying every second, 7 seconds, you know, and
try this: 75% of all dogs in America are overweight. Okay. I mean, here we are, a society that is with fat animals while we ignore the poor of the world.
Yeah, but then, and then you ask the next question in our neighborhood, though, and you go, why are people eating healthy? Where's the nearest grocery store?
Exactly.
Right? They're walking 20 blocks to
where
get to the
grocery
store.
Where can
you get vegetables? Right. Where's the nearest Whole Foods? Well, I'll tell you, there's no organic grocery store anywhere near our neighborhood. And part of that is beginning to go, let's think about how we can raise some of our own food here. And so now we have kids, you know, that are growing a tomato, and they see a tomato grow, and they're like, you can't eat that. And we're like, yeah, you can. It's a tomato. You know, and these kids are like, that's awesome, you know, because they see that, and they begin to, I think, connect again with that God has a different dream for this earth. God has a different vision of how we eat and how we consume, and it's not just going out and buying a hamburger, which was a little tricky because I grew up in East Tennessee, you know, and my family raised beef cattle, so whenever I would go home, I mean, I love meat. I'm one of those vegetarians that, like...
That's my grandson. Pop, I'd be a vegetarian, but meat tastes so good.
That's right. It's been a journey for me of seeing the things that you said. You know, that to make 1 pound of beef, it takes 12, 14 pounds of grain. And that the cattle in the industrialized countries are eating as much grain as the entire population of India. Like, we could feed so many people with that. And then I would go home, and so I would just say to myself, I don't eat beef anymore. I'm a vegetarian now, you know? And he would say, well, that's great. You've either got to mow the yard or eat the cows, because that's how it gets done, right? But now he pointed out to me that they raise their cattle off the land. And there's this really beautiful connection between some of the things that we're trying to live out and some of the things that my family as small town farmers in East Tennessee are doing, you know? And there's voices like Wendell Berry, who's someone I really love. And Wendell Berry says that our money in the United States says in God we trust, but our economy mirrors the seven deadly sins. You couldn't get any closer to an economy. It's just built around these things of consumption and greed and lust. And so now when I go home, I was looking at my stepdad's farming book, and the foreword was written by Wendell Berry. And I'm like, yes, because there is so much that we have in common. So now I go home, and I eat down on some hamburger because I know that it was raised, you know, with some integrity, like off the land that my folks are you know, running their little family farm. But then I come back to my neighborhood, and I think that's where we have to have a little grace with each other, because I've met plenty socially conscious progressive folks that have such a self-righteousness that it mirrors the conservatism that I grew up with. It's like, thank you that I eat all organic. I'm not like those people, right?
The ultimate Pharisee, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, you know, the marks of the evangelical Bible-believing Christian was, I don't smoke and I don't chew and I don't go with girls who do.
Yeah.
You know, you had these pieties, and we judge people in terms of whether or not they were into the pieties that we felt were essential for Christians. We Christians don't. And so we move away from that, and it's so easy to get into a lifestyle of simplicity.
Yeah.
And that becomes a new legalism, doesn't
it? Yes, it does.
It becomes a new way of saying, if you don't do this, you're not really spiritual.
Yeah.
And that's what I've always liked about you, that you, people who are around you don't really feel like you're out there to condemn, or, you know, you've made this decision, you've decided to live this lifestyle, and you want to model it, and you want other people not so much to imitate you, but to imitate Jesus as they understand Jesus.
Yeah.
And it's just that people aren't thinking through their own lifestyles. So you've thought through yours, I'm thinking through mine, and we call upon everybody to think through their respective lifestyles and say, in what way am I living economically? Am I living in lifestyles as Jesus wants me to live, do you see?
Yeah.
And that goes beyond the pieties and the legalism. But we always have to be careful that we don't go around dumping on people who aren't into our way of thinking. You know, there's this great story in the Bible of Ananias and Sapphira. You know, the disciples are all coming, and they're bringing everything they have and laying it at the apostles' feet, and they're giving to people in accord with their need. And it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. And along come Ananias and Sapphira, and they put this stuff at the feet of the apostles, and they say, everything we have is here. It's everything we own. We're totally surrendered to the wealth of the community rather than to our own personal wealth. And they lay it down there. And the apostle gets mad. Peer goes ballistic. And of course, as you know, each of them is stricken dead.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing is, they are not stricken dead because they didn't give it all away. That's not the judgment. The Apostle Paul, Peter, is really upset with them, not because they didn't give it all away. As a matter of fact, he says, look, this was your stuff. If you wanted to keep it, it was yours to keep. Nobody said you had to do this. Nobody said you were going to be somehow unspiritual if you didn't do this. But what we don't want from you is to come and to play this game of pretending, of lying about it, of letting people think that you have adopted a sacrifice that, in fact, you haven't adopted at all. So there's no real judgment on the part of the apostles of those who don't buy into this life of self-denial. There is a sense in which you better not play games with God.
Yeah.
You better not play games with the church. You better stop pretending to be what you're not really. That's what is really condemned in that story.
And I think it's a good thing that God's not into striking folks dead like that anymore. Yeah. We wouldn't have to worry about our big buildings anymore, you know, smaller congregations. But the thing about in our neighborhood, too, is that I've become convinced of is you can live a socially conscious, disciplined life and still be distant from the poor.
Yeah.
You can believe all the right things, protect your way of living so that everything is bought with some integrity. And what's even more important to me than that is being close in proximity to people who are suffering and people who are poor. Because
we can
sell everything we have and give it to the poor, but if we don't have love, it's nothing.
You know? I heard you say something that impressed me, and it was a kind of deconstructionist reading of the scripture, where somebody said to you, doesn't the Bible say, the poor you have with you always? And I remember your response. Do you remember?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting where Jesus says that. Because he says it from the home of Simon the leper with a marginalized woman pouring perfume on his feet and the poor all around him. And what's incredible is many people take that verse to say we don't need to worry about the poor. We worry about evangelism, you know?
Yeah.
But I think it's just the opposite of what Jesus was saying. Jesus is saying, the poor, you're not going to have to worry about finding the poor. The mark of the church is that the poor find a home in your midst.
Well, the line I was referring to was one time when you said, when somebody said, the poor you have with you always, your response was, oh, and I suppose you're always with the poor.
Yeah. Where are they?
If the poor are always, or do you really live among the poor? And I think that goes back to what you were just saying. That, and to a large degree, the simple lifestyle doesn't simply arise out of a sense of guilt and I'm going to be a pious person, but living in relationship with people who are in need and responding to them in their need. In short, it's not because there is a rule that says you've got to give up this and you've got to give up that and you've got to give up the other thing. It's because you're in proximity with people who are in need and your love for them causes you to share what you have with them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the verses that nobody can ever get away with. Nobody can ever escape this one. I mean, they always have all kinds of things. The eye of the needle, well, it's not really a needle. You've heard
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, there's a passage in 1 John 3:17 and 18. Everybody knows John 3:16, but nobody wants to study 1 John 3:16 and 17 and 18, which says simply this, that if you have this world's goods, and you can look into the eyes of a brother or a sister who is in need, and you can keep what you have while that person suffers, how can you say I have the love of God in my heart? Boy, that gets down to where it's really where the rubber hits the road.
What I love about the early church, too, is they had that sense that we're going to take all that we have and bring it together and meet the needs in our midst. And one of the signs of Pentecost in the book of Acts is as the Spirit comes down, it says they shared everything they had and there were no needy persons among them.
Yeah.
So they did end poverty.
Yeah.
And but it wasn't just because they had created this communist economy or something like that. The redistribution, I think, is only valuable in as much as it's rooted in love. And Sometimes people go, "Oh, you guys are communists," you know. Yeah. And now I say, if we really discover how to love our neighbor as ourselves, capitalism as we know it won't be possible, and communism won't be necessary. Marxism won't be necessary, because redistribution isn't just a prescription for community. If you share everything, you'll have community. But it's a description of what happens when people fall in love with folks across class. Is it just makes sense to make sure that this family living next to me on my block has a bed, you know? And when people look at how we're living and they're like, "Oh, that is so sacrificial, so radical," I'm like, "Nah, you'd do the same thing. If you knew Mary Lou and her kids, you'd give your couch to them, you know?"
Yeah, that's right.
It's really the fact that we've moved deliberately into a neighborhood where we encounter neighbors that are in poverty, and their poverty disturbs our comfort. That's all that it is.
And as you get involved on that micro level, on that personal relationship level of meeting people who are in need and looking at your own affluence and saying, "How can I live this way when this person that I know and see and love and encounter day in and day out is in such desperate straits?" You know, there's that personal thing. But you're not into that very long before you realize that you've got to begin to ask questions about the social system that produces these poor people. What is that bishop in Latin America that said, "When I fed the poor, they called me a saint. Yeah. When I began to ask why these people are poor, they called me a communist."
Right.
Eastern University has this graduate program where we train people to go to the third world to start small businesses and cottage industries that people can own and run themselves. I mean, we're not against the free enterprise system. We believe in it. We believe that this is the best way to end poverty, to get into the whole process of job creation. But I always tell my students this, that if you're Christian, you've got to believe in free enterprise for this reason, that God gives to each of us the freedom to make the decisions that determine our destiny, socially, spiritually, and economically. So I want a free enterprise system, having said that.
Yeah.
But I don't buy into capitalism for this reason. In capitalism, the motive for production is to maximize profits. I got to say, profits are necessary. If you don't make profits in business, you don't stay in business long enough to meet anybody's needs. But a Christian in his workplace ought to have a sense, in much as possible, that my labor is producing stuff that people need, do you see? And a great deal of our economic productivity in America today, particularly, is producing stuff that nobody needs, artificially created wants. And while we are producing and consuming stuff that nobody needs, which may actually be detrimental to us, there are people who are in desperate need and whose needs are not met. So I really believe in a free enterprise system. That's why I'm not a communist. That is challenging people to produce and to consume in terms of needs rather than in terms of artificially created wants. And in a capitalistic system like our society, most of the stuff that's advertised on television, nobody needs. You've heard me do my rep on ads, haven't you? You know, where I go on and say, you know, the guy takes the can of beer. He's camping out, and he's by the stream of water, and the fire's burning, and he pulls off the tab, and he says, "You know, guys, it doesn't get any better than this." And I tell the students, what is being sold here? A can of beer? Or are they trying to convince you that friendship and this sense of peace and well-being is being sold? Nobody needs the beer, but you do need this kind of sense of well-being and friendship. I always like to make fun of the most famous ad that's ever been produced, you know, the Coca-Cola ad, you know, where they're on the top of a mountain, and they're from every nation on the face of the earth. They're in their native costumes. It's the day of Pentecost. They're all holding hands. Going to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And you're saying, perfect harmony. What is creating perfect harmony? The Holy Spirit? The fellowship of the church? What? Going to teach the world to sing in perfect harmony. And then they tell you what's going to create perfect harmony for broken humanity. Coca-Cola. And just when you're ready to say, this isn't real, the voice comes in and says, it's the real thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you realize that we're being manipulated subconsciously into believing that these
things that the culture is selling us is going to meet the deepest spiritual hungers of our neat lives, for peace and well-being, for friendship, for something to believe in, for harmony, for broken humanity. No wonder the Bible says, why do you spend your money for that which satisfieth not? Mm. We're not asking that you shouldn't spend money. We're going to ask, are the things you're spending your money on simply going to satisfy you? Because here we are in America, the richest nation on the face of the earth. People are buying and buying and buying. It used to be, if you go to Europe, the cathedral dominated the landscape. Life was centered around the cathedral. Now it's centered around the shopping center. And that's the new cathedral of our lives. And we go on Friday nights and Saturday nights and just wander up and down though and buy stuff that nobody needs. And one has to ask, what's this doing to us?
Mm, yeah. In our neighborhood, we had to start asking questions about that system. And as the scriptures say, we're not to conform to the patterns of the world, but to be transformed, to have a renewing of our mind, to have a new imagination. And we started out responding to a lot of needs, like whoever's at the door, you know, we'll feed folks. We're feeding 50 people a day. And then Dr. Martin Luther King says something so beautiful. He says, we're called to be the Good Samaritan and lift our neighbor out of the ditch on the road to Jericho. But after you lift so many people out of the ditch, you start to say maybe the whole road to Jericho needs to be transformed. Yeah. And that's where we really started to think about...
Yeah, should we put a new lighting system in? And have police patrolling the highway? I mean, if people are getting mugged on the road between Jericho and Jerusalem every day, right. We need to do something about that road.
Let's figure out, or as John Perkins says, we've always been told if you give a person the fish, they'll eat for a day, but if you teach them to fish, they'll eat for the rest of their life. And he says, but we also got to ask the other question that the church is scared to ask. And he says, and that's who owns the pond?
Very good.
Who owns the pond? So we're trying to figure that out, because we live in an area where we can see the other side of the industrial economy. You know, that not only are they trying to sell us an illusion, but they're hiding us from the faces of the Coca-Cola workers in Colombia that are killed and beaten. You know, and they're hiding us from those people that are invisible, that we don't know who makes our clothes. We don't know who, you know, has picked our coffee. And that became true to me when... I will never forget this one demonstration where, instead of just the big activists and lawyers and everything speaking, they flew in the kids from the sweatshops. They brought in kids from all over the world that were working in sweatshops in really abysmal conditions, and these kids just told their story. And one kid got up, and he was a 9-year-old kid from Indonesia. He had a scar all the way down his face, and he said, "This scar is from my master, who beats me." And he said, "He beats me most days, but this one day he had beat me so bad my face was bleeding, and he didn't want me to stop working, but he didn't want me to get blood on the garments I was making, so he took a lighter and he burnt my face together." And he said, "And all that was to make stuff for you." Mm-hmm. And I started thinking, my God, who are those faces that I don't see? And I knew that Jesus felt not only the marks from the nails and thorns, but the mark down this kid's face. Because when we do it to the least of these, we do it into Christ. And I also started asking, who are those masters that I don't even know that I'm giving money to?
And so we begin to ask questions about where we shop. Mm-hmm. Because we go down to certain companies, I won't mention, I don't want to get sued, but you know who I'm talking about, this big multinational company with stores that are in every city and town and village in America, and we go in there and we buy bargains. Oh, man, you can't get anything cheaper than at that place, man. And they're made in third world countries, and often, not always, but often the people who produce this stuff are exploited. I mean, they are beaten. They are put to work. This child is messed up because he's producing stuff in that factory so that we can have bargains. And, you know, here we all are. We claim to be compassionate people, but we live off of consumer goods that are produced at bargain prices in third world countries. And, you know, we say that's just the way it's. That's great. We're creating jobs for them. Jobs, yeah, jobs. And they're jobs that in many places dehumanize, oppress, diminish the dignity of people. And so, you know, when we buy, we have to ask ourselves some very serious questions. You say, my goodness,
as Christians, you're going to have us asking not only about how we live, but where we buy stuff and how much we're spending. And yeah, whatsoever a man doeth or a woman doeth, in word or in deed, he needs to do heartily as unto the Lord. You know, when we were, the passages of Scripture that I've always talked about, and when I deal with the students in sociology, I always point out that when the Apostle Paul uses the phrase principalities and powers, which he does all the way through Colossians, all the way through Ephesians, he's not just talking about evil spirits. I mean, he is talking about evil spirits, but not just evil spirits. He's talking about all those forces outside of ourselves that are molding our behavior, that are conditioning what we do and what we buy and how we eat. These are all principalities and powers. That there are evil forces out there that are manipulating us, that are controlling our behavior, the media, supermarkets, the stores, the bargain centers. All of these are principalities and powers. And it says in Ephesians 6:12 that we're not only to wrestle against flesh and blood, you know, the sins of the flesh. You know, don't dance, it stimulates the lust of the flesh, which it does. Be this as it may, we're not only to wrestle against the sins of the flesh, but the Scripture says we're to wrestle against the principalities and the powers.
In this dark world.
And the rulers of this age. Mm. And in case you want to know what the task of the church is, it's not to build just more and more buildings. And we've confused growth with getting fat in the church. Mm. Churches get fat without ever growing spiritually. But here's what it says.
I call it supersized church.
Yeah, there you go. There's a great line at the end of the first chapter of Ephesians where Paul writes, and what God wills to do is to bring all principalities, all powers, all dominions, all thrones, this is a great line, into subjection to himself. Are you ready for the next line? Through the church. Mm. The church is not irrelevant. The church is chosen by God to be the primary instrument to bring these principalities and powers, these thrones and dominions into subjection to God so that they don't do the horrible things that they're doing to people and creating the poverty, all in order to nurture our consumptive lifestyle.
You've been listening to one of the 8 parts of Tony and Shane Uncut, a conversation between Tony Campolo and Shane Claiborne. To learn how this powerful dialogue came to be, listen to episode number 3, The Saga of Simply Enough. The link is in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Our hope is that you will be so motivated by this series that you will want to share the message with others in your congregation or group. Order a copy of the DVD, Choose Justice, with his extensive discussion guide from the store at thesimpleway.org for only $10. It is also available from World Vision Canada and from Tony Campolo's online store. All those addresses are given in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. See pictures of Alternative's crew in Philadelphia producing the original and links to the bonus video segments. Links are in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. To get better acquainted with Tony and Shane and their ministries, follow the links in the show notes. Each episode of Tony and Shane Uncut, including the podcast and the show notes, will be released to iTunes, Stitcher, and the other podcast directories about the 1st and the 15th of the month, May through August. However, if you want to hear more of the 3.5-hour dialogue, you can. Go to simplelivingworks.org, window number 3, click the episode index, scroll down to the backup section, click on the episode of your choice. Sorry, you can only download episodes into your iPod or smartphone, as each episode with its show notes is released to iTunes and Stitcher. Those instructions will be given in the show notes of each episode, so if you want to listen to one and then hear more, you can. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to feedback@simplelivingworks.org. Leave a message on our Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. All those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click on window number 3. In addition to this podcast and its show notes, we produce new Simple Living Works blog several times a week. We hope you'll read it and subscribe. This blog is the companion to our 2 times a month podcast. The content is different, though the subject is the same. Click on blog at the top of the show notes for each episode. As one of our early and long-standing supporters of alternatives, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, known as the ELCA, has pledged to keep a copy of each resource produced by alternatives and to make copies available by request at a nominal cost. Feel free to contact them at the offices near Chicago. The complete contact information is given in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. In the next episode, I present the next of 8 parts of Tony and Shane Uncut. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Subscriptions are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Pinterest. Urge your friends to do the same. Provide your email address to receive our monthly Simple Living Works e-newsletter. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We do, of course, recommend and urge alternative giving. Thanks to John Pitney and the band Earth Mama for the music on our show. Find details in the show notes at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Thanks also to World Vision Canada, who now owns the audio of Tony and Shane. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works Podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can simply live. Learn to live simply so others can live.